Welcome to the Smart Tech Check podcast, hosted by Mark Vina, your home for candid, insightful, and provocative conversations about the smart home, home automation, security, smartphones, PC and console gaming, and much more.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mark Vina, host of the Smart Tech Check podcast. Today is Friday, April 18th, 2025. Joining me for today's podcast are Stuart Wolfram, who scribes for Popular Mechanics, AARP, Techlicious, Investopedia, and other fine publications. John Quain, who writes for the New York Times, Smart City, and Tom's Guide. He also loves to hang out with Elon Musk, but we won't talk about that publicly. And Rob Pegoraro, who writes about tech developments at PC Mag, Fast Company, and other publications, can't join us today because he's traveling on the Blue Origin flight with which we're actually going to talk about. We're actually going to talk about that in a few moments.
Yeah.
John, how are you? How's things going?
Very good. Very good for me. You're actually really good. So, yeah. Busy.
And Stuart, hey, Stuart, what's your quick 30-second assessment on the baseball season so far?
Hey, the Mets are in first place, and we won last night. I'm always in a much better mood after a Met victory.
There you go.
Well, the Yankees have actually won four in a row, which is crazy. You know, with the
Max Fried was a godsend.
Oh my! Can you imagine hit where the Yankees are right now? You know, so we should do a podcast on the whole torpedo bat thing. I mean, we should really talk.
Happy to do it, and we can talk about Babe Ruth's 48-ounce bat.
Yeah. There you go. Well, let's just jump into it. We kind of talked a little bit about, we were making some jokes about the Blue Origin thing, but you know, Stuart, and I applaud you. You did a great short clip on these, and I think it's fair to say attacks on those. I'm not going to say they're brave women, but at the end of the day, I mean, they did what any of us would do if we could swing it from a dollar standpoint. They, you know, essentially were passengers on the Blue Origin ship via the largesse of Jeff Bezos. But there's been a lot of these attacks. I think part of this goes to the whole, you know, John may have a different view on this, but part of this goes to the whole. These are wealthy people. They got nothing better to do with their money, and I don't subscribe to that. I think that the reality is that, you know, we are getting to a point, it may not be right now, but within 10 or 15 years, space travel may become a very consumer-based type of activity. And a lot of things will have to happen for that to happen, you know, from an infrastructure standpoint. But, you know, history is replete when new technologies, new capabilities come aboard. Well, guess what? The people who espouse them and promote them and mainstream them are typically wealthy people. You know, and I don't, you know, I don't wake up in the morning jealous of how much money Tim Cook has. I think most people are like that, you know, but John may have a different viewpoint, but let me flip it over to Stuart. What was your impetus to do this?
Well, as you both know, I'm a tech historian, and I've been studying tech history and how things become disruptive or mainstream. And I think all three of us know this, and I'm sure a lot of the listening audience knows this, that there is a five-step process, marketing process, to introduce something new into the consumer marketplace. You have the innovator, you have the early adopter, you have the early majority, you have the late majority, and the laggard. The innovators, from a demographic point of view, and I am not saying this is good or bad, I'm not applauding or cheering. This is just how it is. The innovators are usually people who love tech, but they can't necessarily afford it. The early adopter demographic is always the wealthy. The first person to have his house wired for electricity was J.P. Morgan, and his neighbors hated him because he had a DC power plant in back of his Park Avenue mansion that drove all his neighbors nuts. In 1910, Teddy Roosevelt and Harry Houdini became famous for becoming flyers, which, again, not a consumer thing yet. In the history of technology, particularly, the early adopters were always rich people, and their purchases were always seen as frivolous. I'm sure you know history yourself that when in the early days of the cars, anybody who's seen the Magnificent Ambersons, for instance, Joseph Cotton's character, everybody yelled at early car owners to get a horse. And they thought the car was the most ridiculous thing ever. You could go all the way through every single technology, whether it was radio. The first radios cost $500 in 1920 money when the annual income of Americans was about $3,000. Yeah. Color TVs were $1,500 when they first were manufactured in 1954. And that's in 1954 dollars, which is about $9,000 or $10,000 today. None of these, the home computer, you guys have to remember this. When people were talking about the home computer, the reaction of most consumers was, why do I need a computer at home? And now we all carry one in our pocket. Even Steve Jobs was laughed at for charging $500 for the first iPhone. You should go back and read the early reviews of the first iPhone. Everybody excoriated him for making this frivolous, expensive product.
Hey, I wasn't around when the computer was introduced. How old do you think I am? No, I'm just kidding.
You're a young whippersnapper, you?
I think that's the right read. But here's the question, and I'm going to give this to John to get his perspective. But I also would like to understand, what is the psychosis that drives this? You know, and I don't want this to descend into a political discussion, but I don't understand why, because I think a lot of the focus here has been on, these are wealthy women that have a lot of money, you know, and they're doing something that a portion of the population, and I think it's a minority, because generally income type of tax, it's not, I don't think that represents the majority of the way most people feel. But those people, usually a small minority, has a very loud voice. They're willing to scream the loudest. But, you know, what's your assessment, John?
Well, I mean, there's a valid point, I think, lurking behind some of these nasty kind of memes that were out there. It's about opportunity costs, right? And a utilitarian viewpoint of looking at what we're doing here and sending that group of people. There were two scientists, I should say, look, there were two scientists on board this flight. Probably worthwhile.
Amanda Nguyen.
Right. Worthwhile passengers. But the rest, you know, that was just kind of for fun. And so the argument goes back to even Gil Scott-Heron had a song back in the 70s about Whitey on the moon. Right. Why are you sending and spending billions of dollars? Then it was millions of dollars to put Whitey on the moon. And you've got some serious problems back at home. And that's a valid argument. And that discussion could be had about whether it's worthwhile to spend the money on this, especially this particular flight. It can't be said, you know, well, there was this tremendous scientific value and setting them up for 10 minutes. There wasn't. But there is a different issue, and that is sort of to Stuart's point about the sort of public relations value that a flight like this has. It brings a lot of attention to it, which is a good thing. And Katy Perry is basically, you know, what we do in the endangered species and stuff like that. She was our charismatic animal on the flight, right? You know, you pick the panda bear and you say they're going extinct, or, you know, those are the things that get people going. So that got a lot more attention. Whether she was high or stoned or not in the flight is sort of beside the point if you watched it. Oh, my goodness. But, you know, look, so it's not really fair to criticize them for that. And also Gail looking so frightened when she got on the flight. Oh, my goodness. So if you haven't seen that, you should go back and take a look at the video. It's really quite funny. But I think a lot of us, but it is that, again, it's that PR point, which is not zero value. It's important to draw attention to these technologies and things, and that's sort of what that is all about. So, you know, that's really was the point of it. And yeah, people were pretty mean and unfair to them, I think.
I want to push back just a little bit, John, you ignorant slut, on the whole money being spent worthwhilely.
Right.
And I think this is one of the things that is, ever since Gil Scott-Heron and the huge protest against the Apollo flights and the Gemini and the Mercury flights in the 60s, solving problems on Earth and going to space are both interconnected and have nothing to do with each other. Those are two different pots of money. When one of us decides to go on vacation, which one of us says, oh, I'm not going to go have fun. I'm going to give the money I would have spent on vacation on something worthwhile here on Earth. All we're talking about for some of these women, and remember, not all of them paid, is the number of zeros, number one. Number two, what if that had not been Katy Perry, but been Taylor Swift? Are we dumping on Katy Perry because her last album flopped?
She was high. She was totally high.
It doesn't matter. I don't care if she was high. Quite frankly, if I got high, I probably would have tried to get high before I got on the thing. That what would have happened? What would the conversation be now if that ship had exploded? What would that conversation be now if the parachutes didn't deploy? We would be having a completely different conversation.
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think you would say, why did they put these people at such a frivolous risk? Why do it for any? There's no scientific value. It would have been the same discussion, you know, why did you do this?
No, because it's still a different conversation. It's not they were having a joyride, but why did we put them at risk? That's a different conversation. Just the same conversation we had in January of 1967 when the Apollo 1 fire happened and the three astronauts were burned in the fire. Why are we putting people at risk? And every astronaut who were friends with Roger Chaffee, Ed White, and Gus Grissom said they would have wanted us to continue because this is the way we move forward.
Right, but those were scientists and astronauts. These are not. The point of that's a big difference.
And a mandolin were scientists conducting experiments. And you laugh at them, but look it up. They both were conducting experiments. Both of them were in the astronaut program. And they probably didn't pay for themselves to go. They were probably paid for by the money that Gayle King and Katy Perry paid for them, in the same way that J.P. Morgan was a founder of General Electric, not an engineer. So every technology that we've come to know, and that whole lady on the moon crap, we would not be able to be complaining about this in the way that we are complaining about this, on the medium that we are discussing it, on the devices that we are using to discuss this, if not for the space program. And we may not see it in our lifetime, but there is already a burgeoning space industry, and it is only going to grow. And the only way that we get that accepted into mankind is if there is a certain degree of frivolity to normalize the technology and to normalize the activity. That Gordon Gekko in Wall Street was made huge fun of because he was very fancy using his cell phone. I remember that anybody who had a cell phone in the mid-80s was laughed at for being a big shot. And now you can go into any convenience store and buy one for $25. That doesn't happen unless you have the frivolity at the beginning of it. The people who were made fun of, the go-get-a-horse people who early had cars. This has been the train, the whole scheme of how technology gets to be a commodity is a frivolous state. Rich people being frivolous. This is always how it works. I'm not applauding it. I don't think it's a great thing or a bad thing. It just is.
But I think you're missing the point about having the conversation and making careful, considered judgments about how you're using that technology, even in this early stage. I was one of the I was one of the very first people to ever have a cell phone in San Francisco. I opened it, it ran off in a restaurant, and the whole restaurant stopped. You know, so I know that feeling. That's what we do. We review the cutting edge technology. That's all we do. But you need to have that conversation. It's a valid question to ask. I think it's a serious question to ask. Are you missing opportunities when you do a stunt like this, when you've already done these stunts, which is fine. And I pointed out, you know, I think it's a good thing to have those charismatic animals. You've got to get people's attention. But it's a worthwhile question. It's not a frivolous question to ask, gee, should we be doing it in this case? Which is, I think, where some of those mean, nasty memes came from. I think that's a fair question.
Who's we
the people that
Blue Origin is a private company, and this flight was not paid for by taxpayer dollars.
But we give them licenses to do these flights.
No, we. The error was probably Blue Origin's by making this the Katy Perry Gale King flight instead of the A. Chabot Amanda Wynn flight.
Yeah, but it's not about who spent the money. There's a
Lauren Sanchez is a licensed pilot and owns an aviation company. An all-female aviation
company. Guys, this is going to be a fascinating process when I create the viral clips that are going to come out of this podcast. But we got to be careful. We got to move on. But thank you for the very spirited discussion.
Sorry, my wife and my friends will tell me I'm way too intense. Well, and I travel together, it certainly knows that.
And I'll just end it by saying we won't go into the area that Wendy's sent out of.
Yeah, that was weird. That was definitely weird. Oh my God, yeah.
Why they would wade into this, who knows?
No idea. Somebody was speaking of stoned. Yeah.
But John, let's get John back on the stage here. John, you recently were in Japan and you did a factory tour. Who was it with?
With Mazda. And I thought, I think it was very interesting to now, because this is a really weird, scary time, as everybody says, right? Which it undoubtedly is. And so there I was, talking to a fine Japanese automaker. And, when I'm sitting with the CEO and he says, yes, things are very fluid, right? Because minute by minute, things were changing every hour about what tariffs might be imposed, were being imposed, would they be pulled up? Oh, no, they didn't apply to certain things. We're still going through that. But what was really interesting to me was, most of these car companies build a good product now. So it's like, it's not about that. It's about dealing with all these external factors, externalities, as economists like to refer to them as. And at the Mazda factory, it's, south of Hiroshima. And they have a really, most of us have been through many factory tours and watched the assembly lines, et cetera. But on their particular line, what was interesting is that they can switch out individual vehicles. So in a single line, they can have coming down an ICE vehicle, a BEV vehicle, a plug-in hybrid vehicle, one after the other in that same line. And so they can kind of adapt to a lot of different requirements, whether they're market or regulatory or what kind of requirements they have. So that was really interesting, I felt. They built this flexibility into it. Yeah, tariffs, they are in a joint venture with Toyota in the United States, building factories, but no factory can be built in time to address any of these tariff issues. That's just not a thing. So but they are, as Stuart, we were talking earlier about when people will see these effects. Well, they won't for a while because Masashiro Moro, the CEO, said to me, well, we've got about 2 months worth of vehicles sitting on lots in the United States. So for the next 2 months, if you want a Mazda, and I really like Mazdas, and you can see my reviews, and a Miata, awesome, the new Miatas, get it now, because after that, who knows? But I just wanted to point out the flexibility that they've built, as much flexibility as they can into their assembly lines. But, whether it can handle something like this is a whole other question.
John, can I ask a question, Mark? How many human beings were on the line in relation to the robots? Because that's been a big issue with the whole building factories in the U.S. and then bringing jobs back to the U.S.
Well, I mean, it's not really fair because they have a lot of sophisticated technology, obviously, on the line. However, their lines are pretty old. I mean, one of the plants was built in the 80s, right? So, it has been obviously retrofitted over and over and over again with robotics. So you have, welding, no human does welding on a car anymore because you have this dance of about 12 robots that go around the chassis and bang, 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 do everything perfectly. There's still a lot of humans on that line, but I watched them and I have to say, I would not want to be one of them, right? And if you were going to open a brand new factory, you're not going to have that many people on the line. You're going to have more robotics on it than you do now. it's fascinating, you know, but yeah, there wouldn't be an awful lot of jobs created, but, and people, as the OEMs have told us too, when we're covering automotive stuff, they couldn't find the people in the United States to work on those factories right now. They're not available. And most of those people don't want to do those jobs. So it's an odd, odd situation to be in this sort of, the supply chain is truly global. And here's a company that has built in the flexibility. Also, to your point about technology, Stuart, too, they take an approach of what they call intentional following. And so instead of Mazda being the first one that comes out with a fully electric vehicle or the next wave of hydrogen vehicles, they test the things they're experimenting and researching, but they follow the bigger players and to see how Toyota or Ford does in the market. And if, you know, it seems to be catching on, then Mazda is prepared. They have designs on the table and then they follow in. But it's very intentional.
And then they make modifications and they put a new layer on an existing technology and they push the technology forward.
Right. So it was very informative, and Mazda is a very, in a way, they're kind of agnostic. It was a good car company to visit because they don't have a, you know, a dog in any particular fight. They can do a lot of different things. And so a very interesting take on the whole situation. And, you know, Japan is another player in this. They're not Canada, which seems to be in a worse position. But
yeah, John, wow. Let me jump in with a question for you. Is that you've been you know, a unique vantage point because this has been your career in many ways, the automobile sector. When you go to a Ford plant in the United States or a GM plant, do you think that putting the cost of labor aside, the level of robotics aside, you think that the United States is caught up, like, is a Ford factory as efficient as a Japanese factory when it comes to building a car?
Yeah, I think they all are pretty much on a par nowadays. You know, from Vietnam, seen factories in Vietnam all the way to Europe and the United States and Japan. Yes, because in order to build vehicles today, you need a certain level of technology, and that's just a baseline. So, you know, everybody's pretty much up to speed on that. You know, the exceptions are hand-built cars. You know, if you go into Rolls Royce, they don't build a car the same way. No, of course not. But those cars cost, you know, $600,000. So, yeah.
And there's only 3,000 built the entire year. So, I mean, the volumes are completely different. You know?
Right.
The other question is, John, was there any discussion about the role of AI in automobile manufacturing? Because, you know, robotics at the manufacturing car level has always been there to a degree, but now that everybody's talking about AI in a big way, was that a primary topic that came up?
And not really. It does in some minor ways in the design phase, early design phase, but they still build. We went in and watched a guy carving a giant clay model of Miata. That is still a thing, even though they're using the latest in CAD/CAM and virtual reality, the highest resolution virtual reality it can with the designers. They still want to build that clay model that you can walk around. And that's still, there's some things it's hard to recreate in that way. One thing, you know, as opposed to AI, digital twin technology is something that they actually use, and you'll see it in other factory floors too, where you have robotics in operation and you want to change it. You want to do a different part, a different chassis. They can move the mechanical parts around, but they want to see what's going to happen when I do that. And they'll run digital twin modeling on it. And it really is helpful for them to figure out and sort of problem solve before they actually make the switch. And that's a tremendous technology that's been really successful. The AI stuff is still, you know, it's hard to apply that. There's not a lot of it. They do some automatic ADAS systems. They're semi-autonomous in their vehicles, getting pretty close as well. But again, that's not AI. It's not there yet.
Well, guys, listen, we only have about 6 minutes left because we had such a fun time with the first topic, and I want to get to this one.
Oh, it's going to be a big deal.
This one's going to be equally fun, I have a feeling. Let's talk about tariffs and technology. I mean, right. it's going to be my point of view. And I know what point of view I'm going to get from both of you guys, especially from John. But here's the issue that I'd like to bring to mind on this. I understand completely that there's a significant viewpoint in the media that the tariff stuff is being done in a haphazard way. There's no strategy. He's doing it as he goes along. But here, let me give you a counter viewpoint. And the counter viewpoint is, as someone who has worked with Chinese companies for a long period of time, and I really think all this tariff stuff, if it wasn't for China, it wouldn't be as hyperbolic right now. But the reality is, and I know both of you guys have engaged with Chinese companies. I've engaged with Chinese companies from a supplier standpoint. I will tell you that the Chinese play by a different set of rules. And I think this is more about the IP issues, the way that we don't have access to, American companies don't have access to China markets, Chinese markets. I mean, it's black and white. There was a great topic that Kevin Leary brought up the other day that I wasn't even aware of, that there are many companies that operate, Chinese companies that are on the U.S. stock exchange that have not complied with all of the regulatory stuff that a American company would have to.
Sure.
And that's a problem, because I can't imagine IBM saying to the U.S. stock exchange, hey, by the way, we're not going to file any filings. They would be laughed off the stock exchange. And that is a big topic, because at the end of the day, when you buy stock in a publicly traded company, it's all about transparency. Which, by the way, many U.S. companies are not completely, they don't the bare minimum. But they gotta be transparent, where transparency is not a hallmark of Chinese companies on a variety of issues. So let me give you that perspective, but I'm going to let Stuart tee off on this topic first.
Well, again, I think it's very, one thing you have to remember, and the thing that I keep thinking about as I think about the tariffs, is going to the dentist finding two cavities and taking out all your teeth just to be safe.
Good analogy.
Yeah.
There isn't an economist or a politician who doesn't think that China needs to have some balance in the way that commerce is conducted. The IP issue, this has been going on, by the way,
for decades.
But dealing with it with a sledgehammer instead of a scalpel is just not only stupid, it's completely and utterly reckless. And as we said before we came on air, consumers haven't felt this yet.
No,
there is still a huge amount of inventory sitting in American warehouses that hasn't been tariffed. So we've got a 60 or 90 day. Remember that most purchases that are made from factories are on a 90 day basis. So there is probably about 3 months of goods sitting on the market. As I mentioned beforehand, this is a new headphone that's being put out by Skull Candy and Sound by Bose, which, by the way, I've listened to, and they're actually really good. Introductory price of $99. They're made in Japan. They ain't going to be $99 for long. My guess is that Skull Candy has laid in a huge inventory of these, and in about 3 months from now, even at their regular price of $129, I don't know how they're going to hold that if things stay as they are. And that's the other thing with the tariffs, is that they keep going in different directions. There's no consistency at all. How does anybody build a business model over the whims of somebody who just decides on day one he wants to do one thing, and on day two he wants to do something else? It's a level of, you need a scalpel, and it needs to be done on a consistent plan basis, and none of it appears to be that way.
Well, as John knows, because Trump is an oligarch. Let's face it, he's an oligarch.
I hate that
word. I mean, I don't think he's an oligarch, but that's a different story. I know that John will probably disagree with that. But
oh, no, he doesn't own the oil company, you know, like they did in what the people do in Russia when they divided it all up. He doesn't own one of those things, but no, he's a dictator right now for the moment. You know, that's what's happening. Whether that will change or not, we'll see. But I mean, I've got, these are a little Noble, which I'm actually wearing and using. Now, these are more like $500 or, you know, up, and they're quite excellent high-end There are more expensive products. You know, how will something in that market in the middle range survive in something like this? But yes, you're absolutely right in terms of technology. But what has been critical for 25, 30 years has been chips. You know, has been microprocessing units, the ultraviolet lithography technologies that we use to make them. All of that has been the IP, and all of that is really what they should have been focused on. Which Biden, I just hate to say it, that's what he was after. Let's build the chip factories back here. We need more fab plants. That makes sense. That made total sense. Now they're going to pull the plug on it, and they want people to be with a drill gun and like putting bolts in the chassis. That doesn't make any sense. You know, that's not. So it's not a good time for that. I don't really know what to say, except buy your TV now. If you are going to do a new car, this would probably be the time. That's a tougher decision to make because maybe those tariffs will never happen. But yeah, I don't know.
But John, let me just assuage your concern. Is that the American political process will kick in. What I mean is, if anything that Trump has proven, he's a very transactional type of guy. And he realizes, because once the pain starts to be felt, not just on cars will be bad enough, but even on items that were like, still would say, a $99 item that's now $150 because I have to build that into the price point. Trump knows, at least he should know, that if he loses the midterm elections, and he gets impeached again, and they will impeach him. It won't be 3 minutes. He will be impeached. And while he probably won't be convicted because you're not going to be able to get 67.
I don't have the Senate.
But here's the deal. It comes up to works, as both of you know. And all of a sudden, he will not be able to have that last 2 years and be able to get some of his legislation through. So I really believe the founding fathers are kind of looking down at this saying, well, let's see what happens here. Because here's the reality, too. Is that once inflation kicks in as a result of the tariffs 3 months from now, it may take now 4 or 5 months for it to wring it out of the economy, wring it out of the supply chain, once everything is, you get back to a state of normal. And the other thing I would say at the same time is that cutting these deals, these trade deals, this is not like, Norway's here. Let's cut a deal. It'll take 3 days. These negotiations take months. I mean, when they did NAFTA years ago, I think that was a 3 or 4 year negotiation. So Trump has backed himself, and I'll be the first one to admit that he's going to have to figure out an off ramp to get out of this deal, you know, because he'll end up getting impeached if the House wins.
I think the impeachment thing as well, maybe because of the IRS, maybe using that or doing all these illegal executive orders, and maybe the impeachment on that, because they are illegal and they will eventually come. But you're being very rational, and I hope that's right. You know, this hasn't been very rational, and we kind of have a lame duck president who doesn't really care. So that's a very big, dangerous aspect of it. And you can't anticipate, like as a Canadian, don't count on it, right? Take it all seriously. Put troops on the border, raise up, cut us off on electricity and hydro, because that's what you're going to have to do, because that's the way. There's no other really alternative. But you're being very rational, I hope. And I think a lot of America hopes that it would go in this kind of orderly fashion. But
I want to know, John, and I have gift cards on Blue Origin for both you and Stuart. So if the country goes down the crapper, you'll be able to eject yourself into space. So, but still,
I think he was just trying to get rid of his girlfriend. I'm just saying. I'm like, that's all I think that was about.
Boy, that joke I can make, and I will make it. Stuart, I'll give you the last word.
Oh, well, rationality. I think the Trump impeachment thing, I think, is a non-issue, because obviously there aren't the votes in the Senate. And even if the Democrats take back the Senate, I don't think there are votes for it. I think the two big things I'm worried about. Uncertainty is always bad for economics. Always. Nobody likes uncertainty. On a macro level, watch tourism. One of the places where America has a huge trade surplus with almost every country on the planet is tourism. And right now, trips to America, foreign trips to America, are falling off a cliff. And that is a huge economic engine for everybody in the country, big city or small. And if tourism continues to hockey puck like that in the wrong direction, that might hurry a recession and inflation much faster than anything else.
Good, that's great. We're going to have to end it there. But I'll tell you why that's a very, very a terrific point to make, is that me being in Las Vegas, as I think I've told you, my cousin works for a major casino, I was with him for dinner the other night, and they can look at, all hotels can do that, but especially Las Vegas, they look in the distance and they know what bookings look like 6 months from now.
Right.
And they have already seen a marked downturn in people booking. Not only just tourism, you know, Las Vegas is a big centerpiece for shows and trade shows, and that generates millions of dollars, you know.
Right.
And there is a concern there right now. But anyway, we're going to end it there. That was a really fun podcast.
Awesome. I'm sorry for being so intense.
You know, Stuart, I blame you. You're just too hyperbolic. But anyway, God, thanks for your time and to joining today's podcast. For our viewing and listening audience, thanks for making the Smart Tech Check podcast part of your day or commute. Please make sure you hit the like and subscribe buttons at the end of today's podcast, or use these QR codes to connect with me. You can also follow me on X at Mark Vina Tech Guy. Stuart, John, thanks again.
Take care.